Maybe our phone lines aren't so great.
Oh, I see. Okay, I hear you now. Well, welcome. Not so far away.
I think we're going to go ahead and try to start the call. It looks like we have a good group on the line. So I'm going to go ahead and mute us all. That way any background noise that happens won't affect the other people's listening capabilities. So we might unmute at the very end if you have any other questions or last-minute comments, chats to carry on. So hold on just a second while we go ahead and mute. Okay, thanks for joining us for our second Carleton Connects call through the Alumni Relations Office. My name is Katie Gardner, and I'm a 2010 grad. Very happy to be here today with Professor Michael Hemesath. Professor Michael Hemesath teaches international trade, health economics, and the economics of the former Soviet Union. He's deeply committed to off-campus studies programs, directing three associated college programs of the Midwest in Russia, and has been the faculty director for Carleton's Economic Seminar in Cambridge five times, most recently in the summer of 2007. Currently, he serves as the faculty president, and he's also the coordinator for ETHIC, which strives to support and encourage discussions of ethical issues within Carleton classrooms and throughout the larger Carleton community. The title of his lecture today is European Budget Challenges, America's Future. In addition, Professor Hemesath will address the role of Japan's current economic state on the larger world economy. So join me in welcoming him today.
Thank you, Katie, and thanks to the Alumni Office for setting up this kind of conversation. This is a quintessentially Carleton sort of event where you get the luxury and pleasure of getting a chance to interact with alums from all over the country, and the intellectual curiosity that is the hallmark of a Carleton student is clearly borne out by the number of alums that are interested in this kind of activity, and I will do what I can to, I hope, make this hour of your time a worthwhile way to have spent part of your day today. I wish we could all be in the same room, because I realize that a lot of people on the line here are actually professionals working in financial markets and in many ways know lots more about this particular topic than I do, but it would be nice to have had a chance to have people talk to each other across different disciplines and geographic areas, but we'll take this as a good way to start a conversation, and we'll see if we can find ways to continue this sort of thing, you know, possibly at reunion events and that sort of thing where we've done these sorts of conversations in the past as well. I want to start by just noting that when I started teaching at Carleton, one of my friends basically said something to the effect, you know, do you really think you're going to find teaching economics interesting, you know, 20 years from now? Isn't it going to be boring doing the same, you know, principles of micro and macro or international trade or whatever it might be? And, you know, at the time I had a kind of a gut feeling that that probably wasn't going to be the case, that I thought I would still find economics engaging 20 years later, but I probably couldn't have articulated very well why that was the case. And, you know, first of all, the first reason I didn't know so well at the time was because I didn't know Carleton students that well, but I think the engagement and curiosity of Carleton students has been something that I've found continually engaging for the past 20 years, and I don't see that changing in the near future. And I'm sure that's true at other schools as well, but I can't believe that most schools have quite that depth of engagement as Carleton students have, which is a real pleasure. And the second thing, and this is something that probably should have been more obvious to me at the time, but wasn't necessarily, which was that the world constantly throws up fascinating new examples of economic changes and challenges and crises that are going to always be fascinating to talk about. And, you know, I have to admit, I think about my colleagues in English who teach Shakespeare, and I think, you know, what new Shakespeare controversy comes up, you know, every 3 months or every 3 days when you're looking at the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, as happens with economics all the time. And this particular topic is a great example of that. This is the financial challenges going on in Europe right now are something that we've been talking about, you know, certainly for the last year, and my guess is that we'll continue to talk about this for a long time. And it's the sort of topic that draws in, of course, economic students, because there are a lot of economic issues here, but lots of political science students, international relations students, history students, and just students that are interested in what's going on in Europe. We have a lot of students that have studied in Europe and are curious about what's going on there. This particular topic has been a way to draw them into the importance of economics, whether they might believe it in their own lives or not. They can certainly see that it has a huge impact on the rest of the world. So, you know, with that little preface, let me make a few comments about what's going on in Europe from an economist perspective, and then I hope we get a chance to take some questions, some of which have been sent in already, and I'll try to take a stab at those. Now, in the last year, the focus in Europe has been on the economic crisis in what has become known in the press as the pigs. That's basically Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, the five countries in the European Union that are facing the most difficult economic situation right now, and they have this cute little acronym that has become widespread in the press. The basic analysis, so the basic question focuses on the role of government borrowing and the impact of these countries being as members of the European Union in general, but more specifically being members of the Eurozone in particular. Those are 17 of the 27 countries in the European Union that all share a common currency and maybe more importantly a common monetary policy. And so the discussion is tended to focus on the crisis as it relates to being a member of the Eurozone, and that is definitely relevant. That's an important part of the issue, but I think it's also important to note that the crisis that is being faced by the crises that are being faced by these countries have some real parallels to some of the challenges that we're facing in the United States. And so I'd like to make a couple of comments about what's similar and what's different about what's going on in Western Europe, in particular among these countries that are facing some budget challenges right now, and the challenges that we face in the U.S. And, you know, I'll finish with, let me give you my conclusion, and then I'll give you why I think that I come to this conclusion. And I'm going to try to make the case that while the U.S. has serious budget issues that are not unlike some of the issues faced by some of these European countries, at the end of the day, our challenges are much less problematic than those of the European countries that are facing crises right now. And that will turn ultimately on a question of demographics, which I'll touch on at the very end. The basic issue is structural deficits. And those of you that are econ majors, I'm sure recall what a structural deficit is, and sadly I can't call upon you right now to test that, but an economist would define a structural deficit as a deficit that exists when a government and an economy is operating at full employment. What is the budget situation when the economy is at or near full employment? And if there is still a deficit in the government expenditures at that point, then you would say the country has a structural deficit. And that's contrasted with a cyclical deficit, which is a function of short-run economic fluctuations. So basically, these countries in Western Europe and the United States all have a current structural deficit. If we all moved to full employment tomorrow, the deficits would not go away. They would still be significant. And the other issue to note is that these are not only do we have a current structural deficit for the current year, so the flows of revenues and expenses are such that we have a deficit, so that's the flow concept that we've talked about in economics undoubtedly in classes you took, but also the stock of debt, which is the summation of all those deficits, is very large in all of these countries because this structural deficit problem is not brand new. It's been around in these countries for, in many cases, literally decades. There was a little blip in the 90s in the U.S. where we didn't have a structural deficit because of great economic circumstances, but by and large, the U.S. has run structural deficits for, you know, the past several decades, and that has generated a large amount of debt. The total debt in the U.S. now is pushing, we're going to come up against that debt ceiling in the next month or two, and it's like $14.6 trillion of accumulated debt for the U.S. And that large number is a function of the size of our economy, but in terms of the overall GDP, a lot of European countries have the same, have a very large debt to GDP ratio. And that's a combination of short-run structural deficits added up over a long period of time to generate this large stock of debt. So the interesting question is that the debt alone is not the issue. The real question is, can a country finance the debt that it has accumulated over the years? And in particular, you can think about a country that has a very high, you know, if you think about a country that has a very high GDP or high debt to GDP ratio. You know, so those of you that work in this area, in fact, I can think of someone on the line that knows this quite intimately. The country that has the largest debt to GDP ratio in the world right now among the developed countries is Japan. They, over their total debt is over 200% of their GDP. A huge number relative to even some of the developing countries that we're talking about that are having, or developed countries that we're talking about that are having some struggles right now. Yet Japan is not in a crisis. I mean, Japan has a series of complicated issues right now with the earthquake, and they've had a hard decade for sure, but they're not facing a crisis in terms of their ability to fund their debt. And so the interesting question is, what is it that causes a country that has a significant structural deficit to get into a problem where it cannot fund its debt, and what allows some countries to have large structural deficits and generate large external debts, even 100% or more of GDP, and not have a problem funding that deficit? Well, the issue really is the ability to service that debt. Can you borrow funds on financial markets, and at what interest rate can you borrow those funds? Or to frame the question from the perspective of a lender, can the country that I'm lending to repay what I lend to it? Does it have the ability to repay what's being borrowed? And that's the big question that these European countries are facing. And in particular, Greece is the country that started this. So let's look at Greece in particular. Greece has a debt-to-GDP ratio of about 150%. So it doesn't have as much debt relative to its GDP as Japan does, yet it is facing a significant crisis that has affected the European Union more generally. So if you put yourself in the shoes of a lender to Greece, the kinds of questions you might ask yourself when you're thinking about should I lend Greece any money is, does this country have the capacity to generate the necessary GDP to repay my debt? When my debt comes due, will this country have enough output, which it can then tax at some level, to repay my debt? Or another question you might ask is, does it have the political capacity to lower spending so that the debt shrinks over time and the government can then use some of those tax revenues to pay me off rather than buying government services, paying for government workers, and that sort of thing? So there's a political question here, which again, as an economist, I have no particular expertise on, but again, those of you that are working in financial markets undoubtedly have to think about these sorts of political risks all the time, and so it's something that's important for economic students to be aware of. And then the third question that relates to these two questions has to do with the interest rate that you'll have to pay. The country's economic capacity and its political will are going to generate some sort of market set of expectations which will set an interest rate at which the country can borrow money from private lenders around the world. And what has happened in Greece was that the political and economic capacity were thought to be problematic enough that lenders were not willing to lend to Greece at a modest interest rate. They were going to require a relatively high interest rate to lend Greece money. And now, I'm sure many of us out there would happily lend Greece money if they paid us 50 or 75% interest. But again, I'm not predicting that's what the number would have been if they had had to go to private markets. But surely the number would have been very high compared to the interest rate that they're paying when they borrow money from their fellow members of the European Union. And so basically what happened was, as Greece found that they were not able to borrow money on private markets at a reasonable interest rate, the interest rate would have been so high that it would have made the debt, it would have made the deficit get much greater and would have further undermined their ability to repay that debt. So there would have been a vicious circle as they tried to borrow money from private sector markets that would have potentially led them to default on their debt. And as the European Union countries looked at this situation and saw that Greece had the real probability of defaulting on its debt, they basically stepped in and said, we, other members of the European Union, and in most cases this, you know, meant Germany. If you remember the discussions that were going on, it was Germany that was going to play by far the largest role in this lending to Greece. But basically the European Union stepped in with, I think the current number is about 440 billion euros of a fund to protect debtor nations within the European Union. Now, Greece is not getting all of that money, of course, but the other European Union countries that are more solvent have stepped up and put that pool of money together so that the European Union countries can borrow from their fellow member countries rather than having to go to private markets. And the interest rates on that debt are going to be much lower than they would have been if these individual countries had to go to private markets. And so this has been a way to prevent Greece from defaulting on its debt. And the repercussions for default would have been huge because many of the banks in Germany and the other richer countries within Western Europe held Greek debt, and so if the Greek government defaulted on that debt, those banks would have faced serious risks, and of course that would have had financial implications throughout the financial markets of all of these countries in Western Europe. So it was really in the interest of these countries to step in and try to help Greece, but it was largely out of self-interest. They were worried about the repercussions of this possible default. Now, the problem is, when they're lending money to Greece, it's not private lenders lending the money, it's suddenly taxpayers in places like Germany and France, other members of the Eurozone, that have the ability to lend this kind of money. And so what you're really doing is you're asking German taxpayers to pay for the profligate nature of spending in Greece that has largely gone to fund government projects and pay workers generous wages, according to some measures, and to pay them generous pension benefits, according to some measures. Now, again, one can debate what's generous, but if you're a German taxpayer, my guess is you think that the Greek retirement and pension plan is probably a little bit too generous from your perspective. So that's the current situation, where you have Greek borrowing and borrowing from some of the other countries in Europe. Ireland and Portugal, I think, have both had to make some use of this lending from other European Union countries as well. And so the question that I want to ask is, so what's different about Greece and Ireland to some extent and Portugal compared to the U.S.? If you look at the U.S. debt to GDP ratio, we are in the high 90s now, about 97% according to the most recent figure that I saw. And actually, just to put this in perspective, I should step back for just a second. You may recall that when the Eurozone was set up, there were criteria that were put into place that countries, macroeconomic criteria that countries had to follow to be allowed into the Eurozone. And one of the criteria had to do with the debt-to-GDP ratio of a country. And as you may recall, and if we were in class, I'd ask you to come up with this number. As you may recall, that number was 60%. To be a member of the Eurozone, the debt-to-GDP ratio that you, the highest debt-to-GDP ratio that you could have to get into the Eurozone was 60%. Now, as I noted, the U.S. is about 97, Greece is at 150, Japan is over 200%, but even the core rich countries in the Eurozone right now, Germany and France, for example, and I'm leaving the UK out because, as you well know, the UK is not part of the Eurozone, although, of course, they're an important member of the European Union. But the two richest countries on the continent, big countries on the continent, have a debt-to-GDP ratio of 80% for Germany and 92% for France. So if you look at the data right now, basically, as far as I know, there may be some small countries for which this isn't true, but for the major players in the Eurozone, none of those players would actually be able to be a member of the Eurozone right now if they were required to meet the initial conditions that were in place when the Eurozone was set up. So all of these countries have had these ongoing structural deficits, and it's been made worse, of course, by the cyclical downturn that we've seen in the past couple of years, but the GDP to debt ratio, or debt to GDP ratio, excuse me, is much higher than any of these countries ever anticipated facing when the Eurozone was set up back in the late 90s. So the U.S. has the same issue. We have this ratio of 97% of debt to GDP. And so we have some of the same concerns, but we're obviously not facing the same crisis that some of the small European countries are. And so the question is, why not? And why are we able to borrow? If you look at U.S. Treasury rates right now, the 30-year Treasury rate I checked last night was about 4.5%. The 10-year Treasury rate was 3.5%. So relative to many historic periods, we're able to continue to borrow at a relatively low rate of interest in the U.S. And the question is, why is that the case for us, and it's not the case for some of these European Union countries? And I think it comes down to three basic issues that differentiate the U.S. from the European Union countries that are facing difficulties. And I'll comment a little bit as well about where I think France and Germany and the U.K., for example, are as countries that are not currently facing crises, but what is their situation? Are they closer to the U.S. in terms of their economic situation, or are they closer to some of the less well-off countries in the European Union? So the three things that I think make a difference or that differentiate the U.S. from the weaker European Union countries, the first has to do with just straight economic conditions. As you look at the economy of the U.S. over the next 3 to 5 years, the basic question that lenders are asking is, what kind of economic growth is going to be generated in this country? Is the country going to be able to generate enough output and enough economic growth to pay off its debt? Or if not pay off its debt, at least to refinance its debt, to pay the interest on the debt and then borrow further. And the basic fact is that the U.S. economy is healthier than these European Union economies. If you look at data over the past couple decades, it's varied a little bit, but generally the U.S. has grown at about 1% a year more than the European Union as a whole, roughly. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that per capita growth has been faster than in all European Union countries, but total U.S. GDP has grown, in real terms, 1 percentage point faster than GDP growth in the European Union overall. And that suggests that the U.S. economy is relatively healthy and capable of generating growth going forward. At least that's what lenders seem to be saying, given the interest rates that they're willing to offer the U.S. economy at this point. So the basic macroeconomic situation in the U.S. is just healthier than it is in a place like Greece, or even in more dynamic places like Spain or Italy. Those economies just don't, it's not clear that they're going to be able to generate the positive economic growth going forward, and that makes the U.S. a healthier place to lend money than some of the southern European countries. I think if you look at places like France and Germany, they probably fall somewhere in the middle. I'm not sure if their prospects for economic growth, despite a very good year for Germany in the last year, I just think that the long-run prospects for growth in those two countries still probably are not as great as they are in the United States. And in part, that's because they're members of the European Union, and that is the second point I want to make, which is that the difference between the U.S. and the European Union has to do with the interaction of politics and economics and the institutions that result from the European Union, the formation of the European Union relative to the U.S. Model of economic, or U.S. economic system. In particular, if you look at what happens in the United States when there's an economic slowdown, as we've experienced in the past couple years, if you look at the flexibility of U.S. labor markets and the ability of workers to move around between jobs and the ability of employers to fire workers or lay off workers if they need to, the data suggests by almost any measure the U.S. has more flexible labor markets. And that makes it much easier for wages to fall when they need to, when the economy slows down. And when wages fall, that tends to keep employment from falling by quite as much. It also makes it easier for employers to hire new workers if wages don't stay high. And it also makes it easier for workers to be laid off if there are not restrictions on employers in terms of their ability to let go of workers when the economy slows down. So in general, labor market institutions tend to be more flexible in the U.S. than they are in Europe. If you've got a job in Europe, that may be great, but if you don't have a job in Europe, that can be a problem. The second issue has to do with geographic mobility. It's just very clear that if you can't find a job in California these days, it may make sense for you to move to Texas. And Americans are not averse to moving across the country and across geographic regions. It's much harder for that to happen in the European Union. In theory, a Greek person who's unemployed can go to London and work, but without the language skills and maybe some cultural differences and certainly with family ties, it may be much more difficult for that person to move around than might be the theory in the European Union. So I think the geographic mobility makes the U.S. A much healthier place in terms of dealing with short-run economic fluctuations. And then finally, the last issue in terms of these institutional differences has to do with the European Union itself. The United States has a much better system for generating the movement of resources across geographic regions. We have a system which is known as fiscal federalism, which basically means that when California faces difficulties, money flows from other parts of the country through the federal government, in most cases, to California in the form of things like unemployment insurance or in the form of things like health care coverage for the less well-off in California. So Medicaid expenditures will go up in California, and some of that money will be paid by taxpayers in Minnesota, where the economy is doing better. So this ability of resources to move across geographic regions in the United States, this system of fiscal federalism, is a hugely important way of letting the fiscal policy policies of the U.S. economy help soften the blow of economic fluctuations in different geographic regions in the country. The problem with the European Union is that they do not have a system of fiscal federalism. There's no automatic set of stabilizers that sends resources from Germany or France to Greece when the Greek economy starts to have difficulty. What the European Union has, or in particular what the Eurozone has, is a common monetary policy, but they all have independent fiscal policies, and that is a huge, huge problem. And this is the point where I want to note, I want to give the economics credit, economics profession some credit here. We've taken a few bad blows recently because of the economic crisis, and why didn't we see it coming, and you know why do these economic models allow what has happened in financial markets to occur. And I think the profession has been unfairly criticized in many ways. But I want to note, in this particular case, I went back and looked at some articles that were written by economists around the time the Eurozone was created. And you can find lots of these, and you know, just to pick one simple example, Martin Feldstein, who's an economist at Carleton at Harvard, and who was president of the Council of Economic, or chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Ronald Reagan, wrote in the late 90s, I guess this article is from the early 2000s, he titled this Wall Street Journal article, Europe Cannot Handle the Euro. And he basically goes through and makes the case for why this lack of fiscal federalism will eventually cause problems in the European Union, exactly like the problems we're seeing today. And so, and he was not an outlier. This was not an unusual argument that was being made at the time. Most economists thought that the inability to move resources around among countries, which were very different, that's the other thing that's important to note, of course, is that the differences between U.S. states and European countries are very dramatically different. If you look, for example, at the unemployment rate, from the lowest unemployment rate in the United States right now, and I check, that's Nebraska. The highest unemployment rate is in Nevada. The ratio of the highest to the lowest is about 3 to 1, 13.6% in Nevada, 4.1% in Nebraska. If you look in Europe right now, the ratio of the country with the highest unemployment rate, which I have as Spain at over 20%, compared to Austria at 4.4%, that ratio is closer to 5 to 1 rather than 3 to 1. So a very big difference in terms of unemployment statistics. The differences are even bigger when you look at income differentials across these countries versus states in the U.S. The ratio of the highest income state in the U.S., which is Connecticut, to the lowest income state on a per capita basis, which is Mississippi, is less than 2 to 1. If you look at the ratio of the highest, the wealthiest country in the European Union, the data I have has Ireland as having the highest per capita GDP. I'm not sure that's still true. But if you compare that to, Denmark is the data that I've got. Sorry, I did check that data and find that Denmark was higher. If you compare Denmark's per capita GDP to Bulgaria's, the ratio is 10 to 1. So what you have in the European Union are much different economic much different economies, much more disparate and varied economies compared to the U.S., yet you don't have a system of fiscal federalism to handle that change, handle those differences when you have short-run fluctuations. So I think that's a huge problem in the European Union, and I don't see how it's going to get fixed anytime soon. So that's a second important difference. So again, the first difference is that the general U.S. economy seems to be better at generating growth than the European Union economies, by and large. The second point is that the institutional differences, in particular, the European Union policies that do not have fiscal transfers but do have a common monetary policy makes it more difficult for the European Union to deal with short-run fluctuations and these long-run structural deficits. And the third issue that is a huge difference between the European Union and the United States has to do with demographics. This is really a long-run issue, and if we think about structural deficits and the need to get that long-run debt down to a manageable level, that's going to turn on the issue of demographics. If you look at the population growth rates, the first number I looked at was fertility rates. You know, fertility is basically the number of children per woman, and the replacement ratio, the replacement rate is 2.1 children per woman will allow you to have a stable population in the long run. Now again, we'll get to immigration in a second, but this is just fertility. So which countries in the European Union have a fertility rate above, at or above 2.1? if you just took population growth based on fertility in the European Union, which country would have a stable population? Well, again, I wish I could see the answers you might come up with. The short answer is none. None of the countries in the European Union have a fertility rate that would allow them to maintain their current population. I did find one country that was close. If you look at Iceland, Iceland apparently has a fertility rate that's very close to replacement, which is probably a good thing. It's a little hard to immigrate to Iceland. I'd also be curious to look at more recent data. The data I have is from 2007, so it wouldn't surprise me if the recent economic downturn may have brought their fertility rate down as well. If you look at the fertility rate for the United States, we're right at replacement. It's 2.116%. The fertility rate is 2.116. So we're just a touch above the replacement rate in terms of fertility for U.S. Women. But, of course, you then need to consider immigration. Population is both a function of fertility of the current domestic population as well as immigration that comes into the country. With immigration, there are some European Union countries that do manage to have positive population growth. France, UK, and Spain all have population growth of between 0.5 and 0.6% annually. So population is growing at a half to 0.6% a year in those countries. But in Germany, for example, and in many of the southern European countries, even with immigration, there's negative population growth, according to the CIAA fact book. The U.S., on the other hand, is growing at a population of just under 1% a year. So fertility is keeping us stable, and we have immigration, which allows us to grow at just under 1% a year. The other issue about population growth, it's a function of immigration, which probably would merit a completely separate discussion, would require expertise far beyond that of an economist, is the question about how well countries integrate that immigrant population into their domestic economy. The U.S. may not be perfect at this, but I think that the United States does a far better job of integrating immigrants into the U.S. economy than Europe has managed to do in integrating its immigrants into the domestic economies of the European Union countries. There are some significant challenges that Europe will continue to face in that regard. Britain has probably done the best compared to the other European Union countries, but it's not clear to me that immigration is going to be the solution to the demographic challenges that are being faced by the European Union. The other side of the demographic question has to do with the aging of the population. And as you well know, for the United States, but it's certainly true for Europe to an even greater extent, the population is aging, and so that makes this demographic issue even more of a problem. If you look at something which is referred to as the carrying ratio, the dependency ratio, sorry, the number of retirees compared to the number of workers currently employed, the dependency ratio is dropping in Europe as it is in the United States, but it's dropping faster in Europe because they're aging more quickly than we are, at least in some of the bigger countries, Italy, France, and Germany, and the underlying workforce is not growing as quickly as it is in the United States. So their dependency ratio is shrinking more quickly than it is in the United States, and that makes it much harder to raise taxes to pay for the deficit spending that's going on in these countries. You know, so in short, to wrap up here, I just want to note that the United States still has serious budget issues to deal with. There's no question about that. But relative to what a lot of our European Union allies and friends are facing, we have a much better long-run prospect, I think, because our economy seems to be better at generating growth, and we have a little bit better set of institutions, I think, for dealing with, for generating that economic growth, and for being able to deal with short-run fluctuations. And then finally, I think we just have a much better demographic situation. The long-run prospects for growing the population to be able to generate workers that can pay for the Medicare and Medicaid benefits and the Social Security benefits that are going to be a huge part of our budget deficit going forward, almost regardless of what we do in terms of cutting expenditures. Those demographics just look much better for the United States than they do for Western Europe. So, let me stop there, and then we'll open up the line for some other questions. And I've got a couple of questions that people asked about that they sent in before the conversation that I want to touch on briefly here, and then we'll open it up for some other questions from the rest of the group. So one question came from one of the alums who's a wealth manager, and he's particularly concerned about how this crisis will affect the store of value that people might have in terms of cash or in terms of assets. And the question was, do monetary and fiscal policy, what role do they play in taking care of this long-run issue, and how will that monetary and fiscal policy affect assets? Well, I think that this is a long-run problem. These structural deficits are not going to be solved by monetary and fiscal policy. Those policies, as you well recall from your principles of macro class, are designed to deal with short-run fluctuations. The real issue is a question of long-run economic growth, and that's still a challenge. That's not something that economists have completely figured out. We know something about what generates growth, but growth still has a bit of a mysterious element to it, and if we knew how to solve that problem, we would solve problems in places like sub-Saharan Africa quickly, but clearly economic growth is still a little bit of a mystery. But ultimately, it's economic growth in the economy that's going to solve the structural deficit issue. And I think that as long as we don't do crazy things with monetary and fiscal policy, I don't think we're going to simply start printing money like crazy, though we've been printing a bit of it lately. I think that Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve understand that's not a long-run solution to this problem. You know, so I think in terms of assets and the ability of countries to keep the value of their currency, monetary policy is well enough understood that you're not going to have the central bank of the European Central Bank or the Federal Reserve of the United States do crazy things with regard to monetary policy. Though some of you might argue that they've been doing some crazy things lately, that's not a long-run solution. And fiscal policy, there's really no option here for us to increase expenditures. We have huge structural deficits, which are going to require us to have a more conservative fiscal policy. We're either going to have to raise taxes to some extent or cut expenditures, but the ability to generate new expenditures out of in this fiscal environment is almost non-existent. So the short answer to this question is we have to figure out how to generate economic growth in the long run to help us move beyond this current crisis. And so monetary and fiscal policy are not going to be a huge part of that. As long as they're not crazy, as long as they're sensible policies, it's the long-run economic growth that we need to focus on. A second question asked about intergenerational effects, and this is obviously it's not a surprise. This question is asked by a graduate student who may feel himself to be a little bit on the young side right now and may not be that thrilled about paying taxes to cover my Social Security benefits going forward. I hope he can maybe give to Carlton instead, and I'll get my benefits from him that way. But the question here is not so much intergenerational, but it's more taxpayers and creditors off against government workers and public employees in some of these countries. So when I set up the sort of simplistic conflict between the German taxpayer and the Greek worker, that's not a bad shorthand for what's going on here. Now, it might be the German worker, the young German worker off against the Greek retiree or pensioner. That could be a challenge here. It's not clear, even if one feels that the senior citizens that are getting these benefits might in fact not be someone that should benefit at the expense of younger workers, it's just not clear that these small countries or even the larger countries have any real ability to change that dynamic. I don't think that they can go to creditors and say, we're not going to pay you back because we think that you as a creditor have enough wealth and we don't want our workers to be hurt. That's just not really an option at this point. The outcome, I think, is baked in the fiscal policies that have been chosen by these countries for a long time, and their ability to say, we're going to change that bargain right now and make creditors pay for some of our spending, I just think would not happen, because if it did, it would cause a far worse economic crisis in a place like Greece than you have seen already. The Germans and the other European Union members just would not allow that to happen, I don't think. And then there was a third question that asked briefly about state and local budgets as part of this story, and the differences between the U.S. and the European Union. You know, as I touched on before, the fiscal federalism issue is a huge part of the story in the European Union. And I think because most of these countries are not nearly as big and geographically diverse as the U.S., the state and local budgets are often wrapped up and related directly to the government the national government budget. So I don't see there being differences between what's going on at the national level and what's going on at the state and local level in the European Union. In the U.S., on the other hand, that's a different story. If you look at states like California, Illinois, there are some states that seem to have significant pension benefits that they have not, that they have promised but haven't fully funded, and those states are in worse shape than other states which do have fully funded or closer to fully funded pension benefits. And there's going to be a real question about whether the federal government, meaning the rest of the country, is willing to step in and help states that have these budget issues that are not fully funded in the long run. And I'm not sure how that's going to play out. Again, that's a political issue. Are Minnesotans going to be happy to pay for the pension liabilities of Californians? I doubt it, but I'm not sure exactly how that's going to play out dynamically. So with that, let me stop now, and we'll open it up for some other questions. And any comments you may have as well, I'd be more than happy to hear the take of some of you that work in financial markets on what I just said. So welcome to the more general conversation.
Professor Hammerstedt, that was great. Thanks for the call and answering my question. This is Alex again.
Sure, Alex. My pleasure.
I just have a couple of comments. I know there's a lot of people here, so I'll have to say hi to you, and I'll later on talk.
Okay, any other questions or in particular comments from anybody?
Hi, Mike. This is David Wixer again.
Hey, David.
Thanks for getting to my comment.
Sure.
So one of my thoughts, I submitted this actually while you were going, is you mentioned the labor market flexibility of the U.S. as being an asset of us, of ours. So one of the things that's been happening in the last 20 years is that unemployment durations have been increasing on average in the U.S.
Have been increasing.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So you can talk about flexibility of labor markets as the separation rate, the matching rate.
Yep.
You know, how quickly do people go in and out? And that's also been going. Both of those have been going down in the U.S. So my question is we're still better than Europe, but my question is sort of, is that because we're taking more Europe-like policies, something like that, or is it something more inexorable, like technological development that we've just got to grin and bear it, and is it a long-term threat at all?
Again, David, you probably know as much about this as I do. My sense is that it's not because we've been adopting policies more like the European Union. I'm not sure that we have made labor markets less flexible. I think that if you look at unionization and the kinds of protections that workers have and the kind of pressure that public workers are seeing in places like Wisconsin and Ohio, my guess is that there are attempts to make the labor market more flexible rather than less flexible. So I think it's probably a technical skill issue and maybe a generational issue, as the kinds of skills that are being looked for in the labor market may not be matching quite as well as they did a decade ago.
Yeah.
But that's speculation. I think what that really is a dissertation topic, David.
You actually just hit my dissertation topic, so thanks.
Well, you work on that, and you come back and talk to us at Carlton about it in 6 months or so.
Okay.
Maybe a year. Well, thanks for the question.
Yeah. And thanks very much for answering mine. I'm really enjoying this.
Okay, I'm going to jump in.
Please do.
There's a point where we're talking about what people think when they're going to, what governments are thinking before they lend to Greece. And I think, unfortunately, that the question that they ask themselves before they lend money to Greece is, it's not whether they can pay back or if they are, how do I put this? I think the people that are thinking about lending money to Greece, they do not care if that helps. If that helps Greece, and they don't care if Greece defaults. So I think the question that they ask is more like, they don't ask if they can pay back, they don't ask if they can ever pay them back completely, or even the interest. I think that what they ask is, what interest can I charge them so that I can make money even if they default? So I think when it comes to countries, that should not happen. I mean, it's as simple legislation, I think, by the European Union, or like, I don't know, I don't really like legislation in general, but I think when it comes to this, countries should not be treated, even if they are similar to like a company in trouble.
Yeah.
But Alex?
Yeah.
So there's a default premium built in, right, which is the expected probability that they default, and if the country goes further than what the expectation was, then that means the people that lent to them makes a profit. So don't they care, don't lenders care if there's a default on those grounds? That they expected some default, but if you do better than I expected, then I win the bet.
Yeah, I know. The lenders always win, pretty much. That's what I'm saying.
Like, no, if you default like earlier than I expected, then I lose.
Wait, say it again?
If you default earlier than I expected, then I've lost. So it's
that's
not
true.
Always
that's
winning.
True. But that's why Mike was saying that if they charge them 75% interest, they don't care if you default, like, because, you know, you're not going to be buying them at par.
Right. I mean, Alex just pointed an important point.
For 25 cents. And if you charge him 75% interest just to bail him out right now, then you pretty much made all your money immediately.
Yeah.
So and then you just put him into further trouble, which is exactly what Mike was saying. So I think that's something that we need to think about as citizens, I think, in general. I'm not in any position to change that, unfortunately. I hope I was.
Well, then the interesting question would be if Greek citizens could go back a decade or two and rethink the bargain they made with their government, would they do something different? Would the benefits that they've had up to this point in time because of their generous fiscal policies, do those outweigh the costs which they're going to be facing going forward in the future? And again, this goes back to David's intergenerational point. If I'm a pensioner who's near death right now in Greece, maybe I've had a pretty sweet deal. If I'm a 25-year-old worker in Greece, I may be trying to get the heck out of Greece, because I don't see my future looking very good right there.
Yeah, regarding that point, I think, yeah, it affects more the young people because we're going to have to pay more years starting now. But I think this has been happening before. You know, the bailout game has been played for many years. And since, like, in Mexico we have our own story.
Sure.
The Asian crisis is kind of similar in the 90s.
No, I think you're right. I mean, the interesting point, I think, that relates all this together is that often what has precipitated these economic crises has been this issue of government spending and the ability of taxpayers to ask for more benefits than they're willing to pay for. And that generates the structural deficit, which then, at some point in most every circumstance you can imagine, generates, if not a full-blown crisis, at least a serious retrenchment. And the interesting question from the perspective of those of us in the States right now is that has that time come for us, or will we continue to push it off into the future? But I think the common thing that you've described in all these crises, Alex, is the fact that taxpayers seem to be asking for more benefits than we're willing to pay for, and government is not well placed to stop that, given a democratic system, I guess. I mean, I'm not advocating dictatorship, believe me, but the democratic model seems to cause the time horizons for politicians are not always optimal. Let's put it that way.
I agree. I agree with that.
So I guess the follow-up question is, we've got experience with a lot of these places. How long do credit markets hold a grudge if you misbehave?
That's an interesting question. I would look for data in Latin America to see if you could figure that out. My guess is with the new political regime, you might be able to generate credibility pretty quickly. You might look at places where there's been a hyperinflation and to see how quickly a government has been able to reestablish itself as being credible. Maybe they don't hold a grudge that long, and if that's the case, maybe the smart thing to do is to go ahead and play chicken with the credit markets.
Yeah.
I think Katie has to break in here for just a second. We're running a little bit close on time here.
If we have time for about one more question, if anyone else has something that they would like to ask.
Anybody else out there? I can't believe that there are no other questions or comments. Shy Carlton students, that's a shock.
Huh?
Or maybe just being polite. Well, actually, there was one question that got asked about Japan, and I'd be interested to hear those of you that work in Japan. My sense is that the crisis in Japan right now with the earthquake and tsunami are not likely to have long-term impacts on Japan because of the health of their economy and the fact that it was a relatively remote area. I mean, certainly it's bad for that part of the country. Anyone that works in Japan that would care to make a comment on that?
So my co-author is Japanese. I can.
What's his sense?
So his sense is both the remoteness and also the fact that most of the debt is held by the domestic creditors means that at worst you're facing something which is basically welfare redistribution. So it's an internal issue, and you know the worst thing that happens is the government says okay. Now there's some big tax, and it's all equivalent, basically.
Right. So just transfers within the country.
Yeah. And you're not really talking about changing the size of the pie so much as who gets slices of it.
Well, and actually, that's probably a good note to end on in the sense that a lot of it is internal debt. But my guess is that if Japan went to financial markets internationally, they would still be able to borrow money right now. I certainly would lend money to Japan before I'd lend money to Greece or some of the other European Union countries. And that's a function of their overall economic health, I think. And that's the thing that in the long run is going to allow them to recover from this in a way that I think will be surprisingly quick. And countries like Haiti would die to have that kind of recovery, I suspect.
Yeah.
One last thing I just want to add before we go. Some solutions, I think, to the U.S. to my own question, I try to answer it. So I want to give you the answer, and then see what you think. For the U.S., I think population growth would help through immigration. I think we just said right now that we're just keeping it the same at the moment with fertility. I don't know how much it is with immigration, but population growth
1% with immigration.
1%.
Right.
Okay. Well, you know, it's something better that population growth in the growth models usually helps for also economic growth, depending on the conditions. But it's a part of it.
That's right.
Technology investment, keeping human capital here in the U.S. I was hearing somebody on Bloomberg yesterday say that he thinks that ridiculous that we train grad students from different countries in engineering, and then after they finish their studies here in masters or PhDs, they have to be kicked out of the country.
Sorry to break in, but did you see the Wall Street Journal number that Portugal has like a 30% high school completion rate? That was kind of ridiculous, I thought.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
from someone at the National Science Lab, the number of foreign national postdocs is obscene.
Obscenely small or large?
Obscenely high.
And do they stay around, or do we force them to go back home, or can they stay in the States if they want to, generally?
Generally, they're staying now, but if something bad happens, who knows? I mean, and then we've lost a large part of technology there. So.
Yeah. Sadly, if something bad happens, it's all a question of whether it's relatively bad compared to where they're coming from.
Exactly.
But the basic point is that we need to stay healthy here to make it an attractive place to be, and I think the interesting point from the Carleton perspective is with the growing number of international students you see on campus here, one of the interesting questions from an economist point of view is, can we find ways to keep those students in this country as well? And, you know, the health of the economy and the ability to integrate immigrants is going to play an important role. And there are some people on this call that, because human capital, I definitely want to keep in this country if we can do it. Okay, I think we're running out of time. I think Katie needs to call this to an end. But you know, thank you so much for participating in this. It was really great to get a chance to talk to some of you a little bit. And for those of you who are listening, we did get a chance to chat. Please come back to Northfield sometime. Willis Hall hasn't moved, so I'd be happy to say hi at any point. Reunions are a great time to come back as well. The faculty around would love to get a chance to see you and talk to you about what you're up to these days. So thanks for participating, and thanks for keeping Carleton in your minds as you think about the important things going forward.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay. And there we are.